On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, in which I get to learn a lot from the people I talk to, thus the intelligence. And today my guest is Madison Shockley, a black minister with a white congregation, primarily in Carlsbad outside of San Diego County. I met him when he had a black congregation here in the inner city, Los Angeles, near USC, where we're broadcasting from. And you grew up in this area. You played football at Los Angeles High School. You then went on to Divinity School. And you've had this journey that has not ended up in prison, as some statistics would indicate. It's also not ended up with you selling out and betraying the interests of the people you grew up with. You've been a progressive figure within the church movement. And it's a journey that I wanted to capture as part of this series of American originals. So let's just begin with that journey. And what have you seen? What have you done, Madison Shockley?
Thank you, Robert. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's interesting, in the last few years, since Madison T. Shockley Sr., my father, he died going on 5 years ago, I've learned more about my origins. My mother, Audrey Shockley, and father are both from Tennessee, but met here in Los Angeles in the 1950s. And my father came out to California to fight fires during World War II because he was a conscientious objector, and that was one of his work assignments. And he had an interest in returning to California, so he came to USC in 1949 as a student of the School of Social Work. In brief, he didn't finish in 1951 as he should have because of the McCarthyism that was rampant at the time, required him to sign the loyalty oath. And I say this background story because he was my example of not selling out. He was my example of virtue and character. And rather than sign the loyalty oath, he lost his employment with the County of Los Angeles that was sustaining him while he was in school here at USC. And he went to work for one of the black insurance companies out of Tennessee, Universal Life, for 17 years.
What was there in his background in Tennessee that led him to be a conscientious objector in what many people think back as the good war against fascism? On the other hand, he would have been serving in a segregated armed forces. Did you ever discuss
his? Yeah, I did, because at the time when I was preparing to decide about registering for the draft in 1973, we talked a lot about it. I was not a pacifist at that stage of my life. My father was. And I asked him, why were you a conscientious objector? And he simply said, I went to Sunday school and I learned that thou shalt not kill. When he went before the draft board in rural Tennessee, he'd never heard the phrase conscientious objector. He just said, Jesus told me not to kill, so I'm not going to pick up your weapon.
But let me ask you, did you probe deeper? Because plenty of people have gone to Sunday school and read scripture, and they end up being outrageous killers. They certainly end up being warriors and what have you. Well, why was your father?
My father simply had a character that saw things in black and white. And he knew what was right, and he knew what was wrong, and he was committed to doing what was right. And so when he was faced with the dilemma of keeping his job and cooperating with this witch hunt for communists, he refused, lost his job, and went to work. But the ACLU represented he and the whole class of people who lost their jobs and so forth during that era. And he returned to USC in the 1970s, had to redo his first year, got his master's degree from School of Social Work, and went to work back to the county of Los Angeles as a social worker. He just picked up where he left off 17 years earlier. And my mother's story is also interesting. She found her way to California because she was going to school in Memphis, Tennessee, at Lemoyne Owen, a congregational school. Congregationalists built colleges for blacks after the Civil War. That was one of them. And she had a job downtown in a bridal shop. But on her lunch break, she went to the local lunch counter and bought a Coke. And she was standing in line with other white persons. She was about, you know, young 20s. And the
clerk, what do you mean she's saying? But she's a black woman. Right?
Yes, but yeah. they were just buying it at the counter.
Oh, yeah.
And so the line in front of her was mostly white people. And the clerk, she could hear the clerk saying, "That'll be 5 cents for your Coke. That'll be 5 cents. That'll be 5 cents." Then when my mother bought hers, she said, "That'll be 10 cents. And she said, "Why is it 10 cents?" Says, "We charge niggers twice." And my mother swears without thinking about it that she found herself throwing the Coke back in the woman's face. They call the police. They're about to arrest her. She called her father. And my grandfather was also a radical kind of guy, one who, again, would assert his rights even at the risk of health and well-being. And he told her what to do. But when she got out of that little pickle, they all decided, "You need to get out of here." And they sent her to an aunt in Los Angeles, California. So both my mother and father came here as a result of trying to overcome the injustices that they experienced in their lives. Most black people that came to the West were escaping something in the South. And so if you got out here, you had a story to tell. And every black person's life is framed by race at almost every stage of our lives.
Oh, I could give you a startling. Well, we had Mayor Bradley, who I interviewed him on his 60th birthday, which is, you just had your 60th birthday. Yeah. I don't know if I'm supposed to bring that up, but I remember he was telling me that he, you know, even when he got married, he had to worry about which motel he could stay in California, where
yes.
he could go,
yes.
and so forth. Then
yes.
you have probably one of the most important elected officials we've had, Willie Brown, who was head of the assembly and became mayor of San Francisco. And I interviewed him when I was working at the LA Times. And he told me about growing up in Mineola, Texas, where you would go to the movie theater, the Crow's Nest. You'd have to sit up there on the top. And when he would walk down the street of the little town, his father would have to get off the sidewalk and into the gutter to allow even, you know, white teenagers to walk by. So those scars were quite prominent.
Well, and I remember my father, when I was a child, telling me about this rule or law in the South called wandering eyeballs, that if a black man looked at a white woman, they could be charged with what he called wandering eyeballs. And I always found that so silly and so crazy. But now I realize, when I look back, when I was 5-6 years old, the death of Emmett Till in 1955 was in everyone's consciousness. And I just connected those dots. So when my father's talking about wandering eyeballs, he was telling me about Emmett Till, who was lynched in the South because he had allegedly made an advance or said something inappropriate to a white woman and was killed for it. So one of the things that white people struggle to understand about white privilege, when they say, "Well, you know, racism is over," or "I don't think about race," that's exactly the privilege of not having to think about race. We think about it all the time because our lives are framed and defined by it in so many ways. And the formative years of a person's life, they don't just go away. They do shape a core perspective that one has.
Looking back on it as a religious person, how did your family feel about the white church?
Here's an interesting story. So my father, again, being kind of straightforward person, after he was Methodist by heritage. And in the South, it was the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church, CME, or that his family belonged to. But when he came out to the West, they didn't have the segregation, and you could go to any Methodist church that one chose. And my father, rather than going to Holman here in Los Angeles, a renowned African-American congregation led by Jim Lawson, who was in Nashville and Memphis during the 60s, but pastored Holman United Methodist Church here in the 70s and 80s. And so many black folks would just gravitated toward Holman. My father measured the distance from our house to Holman and from our house to Wilshire United Methodist on Wilshire Boulevard. And Wilshire, which was a 99.999% white church that served Hancock Park, was a few hundred feet closer than Holman. So my father said, we're going to the closest Methodist church to us. And that allowed us to be the second black family in that congregation of well over 2,000 people. And so that was my father's perspective on religion, that it should not make a difference. You go where you belong, and we belong to what's closest to us. But that also was a formative experience for me and prepared me for the life that I was able to live. Growing up as an active integrationist, because that's what my father was, without being, you know, overt about it in terms of announcing it, he lived his life in a way that he refused to kowtow to the rules. And so he was always in places he didn't belong or integrating places. That's why we moved to West LA. So I went to elementary school that was predominantly white. I went to John Burroughs Junior High School, which was predominantly white. And here we're in the 60s. And I'll never forget being in maybe seventh grade. And you remember the old tracking system where you had the so-called bright students would go into the AE classes and the regular students would go into the other classes. Well, I was in the AE class in history. And a student, and I don't know how we got to the subject, but a student said to the teacher, I won't call her name, but I do remember it, if black people are supposed to be equal to white people, then why are there only two in this class? Because John Burroughs has started busing in black students from south of Pico. And the teacher was speechless. And all she did was turn and look at me, a seventh grade student, to answer this question. And I simply said, well, I've been in your classes from the second grade. We've had the same education. The students that are being bused in did not have the same quality of education that we've had here at Wilshire Crest and now at John Burroughs. And so that's why I am equal, because given the equal education, I'm here sitting next to you.
But is it only the education? What about the equal home life, the equal job structure, the equal opportunity?
Well, that it was those equalities to a certain degree, of course, that allowed us to be in that school district. Ours was a very middle-class family. Even though I said my father didn't have the opportunity to pursue his career in social work, he was very successful in the insurance business, or successful enough that we could live a middle-class life. My mother worked. She worked for Pacific Bell and up there on the classic building at La Brea and Wilshire. And all four of us went to college. My older sister, Brenda Shockley, went to Occidental and then on to Loyola Law School. My brother, Hillary Shockley, went to Stanford and played in two Rose Bowls. I went to Harvard. My younger sister went to Wellesley. And there's not many white or black families that can put that record up for their family's education.
One of the things I'd like to explore is, you know, why hasn't this been the norm? Of the melting pot, of the American dream. And you know, you got Willie Brown, you got lots of people on a whole, and people point to those examples and they say, well, we did have busing and we did improve the educational situation. And okay, where's the payoff?
Well,
why do we have so many people going to jail who are black? Why is their dropout rate still so high?
Let me stay with my family for 1 minute, because it's something I think that is important. One reason I think my family's had the success that it's had is that we got reparations. In looking at our family history, on the Shockley side, my great-great-grandmother was born a slave, the offspring of the slave owner and her mother. I've often said, no system, not even a system of oppression, is perfect. And so while the norm for black folks in the South in that same circumstance is that they were just cast off and thrown in with the rest of the black slaves, my great-great-grandmother was given a share of the inheritance of her father, along with her white brothers. And so my great-great-grandmother had property in the 19th century rural Tennessee. And my family from her were never sharecroppers, were always landowners, and were always educated. So that's the case for reparations. But it was hardly the norm. And so when you deprive a people of opportunities to be landowners and to participate in society, to have access to education, my grandfather was in year one, the class one of Tennessee State, when it was still Tennessee Normal. There have been 4 or 5 generations of Shockleys at Tennessee State University. But this is just that talented 10th that Du Bois was talking about. For the vast majority of black folks, those opportunities were not there. And so when you go from sharecropper to industrial worker in the city, without education, without stable homes, and stable homes come from being able to own your own home. Growing up, I never lived in a rented house. So when 90% have the other experience, I don't think it's a mystery, the circumstances that we have, and that you also have the new Jim Crow, which intentionally uses every opportunity to put young black males into the system. This is the result that you're going to get. And I was just lucky. You know, you've heard my story before that my first year at Harvard, I was walking across Harvard Yard and the Cambridge police pulled into the campus, which was very unusual. You don't see LAPD here on USC's campus. It's all private and private police. So it struck me as odd that the Cambridge police would pull into Harvard Yard and they had their lights on, but they were blue lights. And I was raised in LA where we had red lights. So I didn't get the heart racing. I didn't have the visceral reaction. I remember saying to myself, I wonder what's going on in Gray's Hall, because that's where they were headed. And before I knew it, they had pulled up on me. Doors swing open, hands at their sides, ready to pull their gun. And they say, stop right there. And I'm like, me? I'm just walking. And they said, give me your ID. I had my school ID. And then they got back in their cars. And I said, wait a minute. Well, why did you stop me? Well, you fit the description. But if I had left my ID in the room, I might have been carted off. So it's just there, but for the grace of God, go I. And so I think it's a miracle that any black person makes it in America.
What caused you to become a minister? And why didn't you, just take the advantage of the Harvard education and become a Wall Street hustler something else?
Well, it was actually while I was in college that I got saved. There in Cambridge was a very special place called St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church, almost 200 years old, because the AME Church is the first and black denomination on the planet and was started in 1787 by Richard Allen. So there in Cambridge and all throughout New England are many very strong African Methodist Episcopal churches. But this particular church was kind of a prototype of what now we commonly call a megachurch. It had a very dynamic pastor, and it was situated between Boston University, Harvard, MIT, Simmons, and a variety of schools where black students would come to this church. And when I was in my sophomore year, I joined that church. And it was a fantastic experience. It was a powerful spiritual experience. It was during the Free South Africa movement, and it was both religious but also engaged with the world. It was a fantastic church, and I wanted to be part of that. And I found myself saying, how do I live my life in this way? And that led to the ministry. And so I was originally ordained in the African Methodist Episcopal Church and pastored in St. Louis and Denver and Seattle. And then I got into the United Church of Christ many years later in 1989 when I came back to Los Angeles.
And when I met you, I really was fascinated because you were involved in something called the Jesus Project.
Jesus Seminar, yes.
Jesus Seminar.
Yeah.
And so as a columnist, you became my go-to guy to find out, well, what does it really say in the New Testament, the Old Testament? What can be attributed to Jesus? So what did you get from all this experience of studying religion and so forth? What do you believe? What do you know? And you're now, I should remind people listening to this, after this seminary experience, had a primarily black church in the central city of Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it was, what, about 10 years ago?
Yes,
you went down
yes,
to Carlsbad,
yes,
which
yes,
is a really yeah, nice Carlsbad by the sea,
Carlsbad
really.
Carlsbad by the sea,
right
yes,
by San Diego yeah, County. And you have a predominantly white church there.
And let me say a brief word about that and then answer your question. So after I'd been here at Congregational Church of Christian Fellowship on Hobart, just south of Washington, which was a UCC congregation, and then I got into politics, as you know, and then I was looking for a new ministry, and I made a conscious decision, and this was really eye-opening to myself. I said, if I'm going to have a career in ministry in the United Church of Christ, and I only pastor black churches, I'm going to have a very short career, because the church is 90% white across the country. And just as an aside, the Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright is also a member of the United Church of Christ, in spite of the slurs against him about being
Barack Obama's minister.
That's
back
right.
In
that's
Chicago.
Right. Yeah, Trinity UCC is part of the same denomination.
Yeah.
But I made a decision that I would apply to exclusively white congregations to test this very liberal church to see if they really walked their talk, and would a congregation that was predominantly Anglo call? Because I'm not appointed by a bishop. The congregation has to call the pastor. And in that process, I did encounter racism within this United Church of Christ. But as I said, no system's perfect. And there was a wonderful congregation of people in Carlsbad who were open to that idea and had even, in fact, discussed it before they encountered me. And so I was called to the Pilgrim United Church of Christ in Carlsbad by the Sea. And it's been quite a journey, one that I've enjoyed, and I hope that they've enjoyed. I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about being black and being white. I like to say to people when they ask me, what's it like? What's it like? I say, well, you know, it's interesting. As a black pastor in a white community, I finally met the rest of the family. I realized in my growing up, living in West LA, going to John Burroughs, going to Harvard, for the first 20 years of my life, every white person I knew was richer and better educated than myself. Everyone. So you get this kind of feeling that, well, all white people are rich and educated. So then I go to an all-white community, and I start meeting the rest of the family and realizing that that's not the case. You know, when they say 25% of the population have a college degree, that means 75% don't, and a lot of those are white. And so in meeting the rest of the family, as I like to say, I recognize we have much more in common than we think.
Okay, but let me get you back to this Jesus issue.
Yes.
And you made yourself something of an expert on, or I should say something, a considerable expert on what parts of Scripture can be directly attributed to Jesus, and what is the record, and was there a Jesus, and so forth.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, not only what have you learned, but I want to ask you whether it matters and what is the significance of this tradition?
Well, I was a student. My professors were the active members of the Jesus Seminar, and their project was to go through every phrase attributed to Jesus as Jesus said X, and to categorize.
These are your professors at Union Theological?
My professors at Claremont Graduate School, Jim Robinson, Burton Mack, were members of the Jesus Seminar. And I was a student at the time they were actually doing this work. And the scholars, about 130 of them, would vote with marbles, black, gray, pink, and red, on each phrase that was attributed to Jesus. Red, the old red letter Bible. Red, this is something Jesus certainly said as far as we can determine. Pink, this is something that expressed an idea that came from Jesus, but we don't have the exact wording. Gray, this is not something Jesus said, but it's consistent with what he said, but the gospel writers added this sentence or idea or story. because it was an expansion on the ethos of Jesus. And then there's a black. And the black phrases did not come from Jesus, and in fact were opposite of what Jesus actually taught. The majority of the phrases in the red letter edition of the Bible, in the Jesus Seminar Bible, are actually black or gray. Only 17% of all the phrases attributed to Jesus are pink or red. So if you only read the pink and red phrases, you come away with a very, very different Jesus. You come away with a radical, peasant, table-turning prophet who said it's the poor who are blessed. It's the hungry that are the concern of God, and they shall be filled. That it's those who are suffering in this world that God cares about. And you better watch out, because when it's all over, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. Or how can we say it in today's language? The 1% will be last and the 99% will be first.
What are we to make of this Pope who seems to have brought new life to a religion that you thought, with all its scandals and its opulence and its archaic traditions and male dominance and everything else, who would have thought a Pope would come along who could be so inspiring? Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised, because if you really listen to what this Pope Francis is saying, he's saying kind of what the pink and the red in the New Testament are saying. He's bringing the focus back to the real concern of the divine, which is those who suffer in this world. And the point of the Jesus Seminar is that if you pay attention and you understand that the Bible is a human product, and that some very conservative forces are also expressed, especially in what they call the Deutero-Pauline letters, you know, 1 Timothy and 2 Timothy and those or 2 Timothy and those Ephesians, where it says, wives, be obedient to your husbands. Those are some of the conservative elements that tried to push back on the original radical Christianity that Jesus was expressing and his first followers expressed. All to say, not everything that says Christian on it has Christians in it. And the Pope's statement about building walls is not a Christian act, ought to be listened to. And he's bringing this focus back to what is the concern. God's concern are those who are starving on either side of the border.
You're referring to his flare-up with Donald Trump.
The one whose name we shall not speak.
But really, here was the Pope taking on this notion.
And he said it very plainly. The person who only builds walls and doesn't build bridges is not a Christian. And that's, I think, a fair statement for a Christian leader to make, because what is the role of a Christian leader but to help define Christianity in such a compelling and clear way that people who want to follow Jesus know which way to go?
Let me ask the question. Are you optimistic about race relations in this country? What was the significance of having the first non-white president? What is the report card you would give? I know you were more optimistic when Barack Obama came in.
Optimistic would be a little strong. I'm glad about a few things. Let's put it that way. I think the new conversation about race is good. I think it's headed in the right direction. I mean, the very idea or concept of white privilege, it has now made it into the common language of our culture. Even though we're arguing about it, we are talking about what white privilege means and how it's operated for the 400 years history that blacks and whites have been on this continent. We still have a long way to go. One of the less optimistic things that I've just recently realized is we've been actively engaged in this conversation at my church and other congregations, and the church still is the place where these conversations are held and being encouraged. So I think the church plays an important role, those who believe we are brother and sister to each other. There's not enough of me to talk to all y'all that need to hear what we have to say. And one of the things that's emerging is white folks have to have their own internal conversation about race, racism, white supremacy, and white privilege. And they have to do it among and with themselves. And we need to build a curriculum that can be used for a profitable conversation. So I won't say I'm optimistic, but I think we're heading in the right direction. I don't think that Barack Obama could have been elected without a lot of well-meaning people across the board. When I came here to USC, when President Obama spoke here 4 or 5 years ago, the line was around the block. And I literally walked the entire block of this main campus to find the end of the line. But it was a thrilling walk, because in that line and on that walk, I saw everybody. I saw America. We were all there. And that's, I think, the benefit and the positivity of this presidency, is that in our best moments, we all do come together.
Last person I interviewed on in this series, Dee Watkins, a 34-year-old young black author who was at one point dealing drugs and everything, and then got, you know, his master's from Johns Hopkins and University of Baltimore, is a terrific writer. He has an attack in his book on the, I forget the way he put it, but it's the Reverend group that shows up after every riot. And he's got Jesse Jackson in there. He's got other people. And they show up, and they're all going to make it all better, and they're going to call attention to it and so forth. I'm talking to the Reverend Shockley here, Madison Shockley. What about it? How do people go along, get along with such a depressing situation of wasted lives? And where is Jesus in all this?
Well, I would only hope, I mean, well, one would hope that this crucible of racism in which we've lived for these 400 years would produce exclusively Martin Kings and Malcolm X's and Medgar Evers and so forth and so on. It does not. And as I alluded to earlier, we are much more alike than different. And that our leaders, Sojourner Truth and so forth, and Shirley Chisholm, Barbara Jordan, these stars are stars. I wish that the common person would take the same experience that these heroes had and respond in the same way, but they don't. And so I think we sometimes lose sight of that, that these people are extraordinary and we need more of them. And they work as hard as they can to try and motivate the mass of people to rise up and resist. But in every struggle, you have those who are co-opted. You have those who are simply trying to survive and don't have time. And for this preacher class that Dee Watson was referring to, I don't disagree with him. Many of them are more form than substance and are perpetuating an image that had meaning in the moment that it lived with vitality. But that moment is gone. And the community and even the black church are not that way anymore. And you talk about the power of the black church, and I went to study black liberation theology. Not every church is a center of black liberation. You have too many congregations that only hear this prosperity gospel, which is a distortion of the pink and red that we were talking about, and is some other kind of religion. And to go back to the answer to that question, I think when people focus on what Jesus taught and the pink and the red of the real message that he offered and take it into their lives, they live differently. And if more people lived in that way and truly followed that teaching, the world would be a better place. But Christianity has worn many garments, and unfortunately, that name Christian, you really kind of have to peek under and look at the label of that garment before you assess what that Christian person, congregation, church, or denomination really stands for. So I wish we had more heroes and sheroes, but that's part of the struggle as well.
Well, thank you, Madison Shockley. I've looked under your label. It's the real deal. That's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. Josh Shearer and Rebecca Mooney were our producers. Our sound engineer is Mario Diaz. And Sebastian Gruba has been the engineer here at USC, doing a terrific job bringing the show. Thank you. See you next time.